a soldier, choosing your battles. Pick yourself up and dust yourself off.
If I told you at the beginning of this conference that Rory Steyn was a policeman for 18 years under the apartheid regime, it perhaps wouldn't have meant as much to you as it perhaps does now at the end of this conference. If I told you that Rory spent years in the presence of Madiba, it perhaps means more to you now that Wilhelm Verwoerd told us about his first question that Madiba posed to him. It seems therefore eminently suitable to conclude this conference hearing from a man who spent so much time learning from Madiba. Please welcome Rory Steyn.
Thank you. I'd call that a warm welcome. Vernon, thank you very much, and to you too, Guy, to Joe, and this incredible initiative. I'm thoroughly impressed. Vernon was just telling me a little bit about who's here today and who has spoken before me, and I have to say I'm impressed. Look at this, we've got a little visitor here. A little praying mantis just came to see us. Check that out. Stick him over there. So, there's a couple of things I'd like to say to you all just before I do what I came to do, and that's to say that I feel really at home amongst a couple of hundred teachers or educators, because my wife is a teacher of some 30-odd years' experience. She's still teaching, and in fact she's probably on a plane on the way down because it's school holidays up in Joburg where we live. So I feel I'm amongst family, and you need to know that. The second thing I'd like to say is that I probably would have been an alumnus of Rondebosch Boys High if things had turned out the way my dad initially intended. My father matriculated from Rondebosch, and I'm the eldest of three boys. Due to some ill health problems of my youngest brother, who incidentally was only the second ever baby in Africa to be put into an incubator at Grote Skier Hospital up the road, where Chris Barnard performed that famous operation, because he was born 10 weeks premature and he had a serious lung condition, and the doctors said to my parents, get up to Joburg, to the Highveld. For the Americans amongst us, Joburg's at the same altitude as Denver, Colorado, looking at about 5,500 feet up, and the dry air up there will probably help him get better, and it did. So I feel that I'm at home in the city of my birth. The third thing you need to know is, where are the Kiwis?
There they are.
Anybody here from St. John's College? Hamilton. Yes, ma'am. It's nice to see you. I must tell you that I only got off a plane from New Zealand via Singapore 2 days ago because I had accompanied my middle son, who's in matric this year. Our school's rugby team toured New Zealand, and we played four matches against four different New Zealand schools, and we were 3 out of 3 going into the fourth match against St. John's College. And they had to call on the dubious assistance of a referee who was an old boy. Anyway, we'll take 3 out of 4 in New Zealand. I think that's a good effort. The last thing I'll say in introduction is that it's slightly intimidating to stand here knowing who has spoken at this conference before me. And I refer in particular to Archbishop Tutu. I know that he didn't tell you this story, so I'm going to tell it to you. But my favorite story about Tutu was when Madiba was courting Mrs. Michelle, Mama Grasa Michelle, who's now his widow. Tutu said to him on a number of occasions, he said, you know, Madiba, you're not setting a very good example here, man. You need to get married to this lady. This living in sin nonsense is absolute rubbish. You need to get married. To which Madiba responded, that's rich coming from you. How do you expect me to take marital advice from a man who wears a dress? So So, excuse me, I think I'll stand here, then these guys on the side can see me better. And I'll leave the notes, the very few notes that I just scribbled down there, so that I can get to them if I lose my place. So let's begin. And I thought that I'd like to begin today at the end. I'm sure many of you, if not all, can remember exactly where you were on the 5th of December 2013. That was the night that our president announced to our nation, and indeed to the world, that Madiba had left us. I can tell you exactly where I was, because I had just literally arrived home. I think I was still pulling back the bed covers at about 10:30 p.m. And I'd been at a cricket match between Australia and South Africa at the Wanderers when the phone rang, and the name on the phone said Deborah Patter. She's a well-known journalist, and she was the co-author of a book that I wrote about my experiences with Madiba. And she said, "Rory, what have you heard?" I said, "What do you mean, Debs? I've just got home. What have you heard?" And she said to me, "I've heard he's gone." And I said, "Okay, stick around. I'll get back to you." And I placed a few strategic SMSs and text messages, WhatsApp, and got the cryptic reply that I need to get ready. And about an hour, just over an hour later, the president made that announcement. The next day, the 6th of December 2013, happened to be my 50th birthday party. My birthday is actually in November, but it's right in the middle of school exams, final exams in this country. So there was no way I was going to ever have a birthday party with a teacher as a wife and three boys at school. So we made a decision to have it on Friday night, the 6th of December. And as I put the phone down, having had this conversation, I knew that that very day was going to be incredibly, crazily busy. And so it turned out to be. I put the phone on silent. I shoved it under the bed. I shoved a continental pillow in there so I wouldn't hear it vibrating all night. And I tried to get some sleep. And I conducted my first interview, I think at 5:45 the next morning. And so it went the whole day. People were ringing up, asking for comments, asking for memories, looking for anecdotes. And that night, this very same middle son who just toured New Zealand, he was the master of ceremonies at my 50th that night. And I said to him, "You know what, my boy?" He said, "Dad, what do I do? You know, Madiba's just died. How are we going to have a party?" I said, "My boy, I've never presumed to speak for the president, but I can tell you, from my experience, he would have wanted us to get on with the party and have a thoroughly good time. So do the right thing. Ask everybody to stand and observe a moment's silence, and then let's get on and have a party." And we did. And it was a great time. Thereafter followed those 10 days, 10 or 11 days of national, very corporate mourning and grieving for us as a nation. And I knew that the government plans, because we did actually plan for that, the government plans would be the president would make the announcement, the flags would fly at half-mast, there would be a memorial service, a very public one, and then there would be the body lying in state for 3 days at the Union Buildings, and then a very private, personal burial at the president's farm in the rural Eastern Cape in Kunu. So I knew that was all coming. And on that Thursday of that week, I went to OR Tambo International with my family. I dropped them off and I waved goodbye to them. And my boys were looking at me with these inquiring, very skeptical eyes, thinking, "Gee, Dad, are you going to get to Italy?" We were going on a ski holiday in Livigno. And I just knew, I can't. I'll follow you when I can get there. Hopefully I can get out of the Eastern Cape in time to catch the Sunday night flight. And I'll catch you guys on Monday morning. As it turned out, that all happened. It went well. And I was privileged to be at that sending off ceremony. It was an extraordinary privilege, actually, because we as the former protection team were invited to the sending off ceremony of the casket containing Madiba's body as it was flown by the South African Air Force from Pretoria to Umtata in the Eastern Cape for the final laying to rest. And in an airport hangar about twice the size of this beautiful chapel that we're sitting in were all the big shots and all the dignitaries of South African political life. And the coffin was in the front with the national flag draped over it, and we were called up 10 at a time to stand 5 on either side of the coffin, just with our heads bowed and our own personal memories and thoughts. And that was a brilliant time to, you know, to say those final goodbyes, because we were not working. Normally, whenever we were around the president, we were working. We had stuff to do. That day, we were guests. And I counted it as one of the privileges, a singular privilege, to have been not only invited to be there, but to form part of this guard of honor. So the casket was flown from Pretoria to Mthatha, and on Sunday I went there working. I had a client in town. I was also kind of plan B for Mam Grasa, in case she needed my help down there for her, her family and their guests. And I stood there as this coffin came past for the final time on a gun carriage, with our senior police and military officers slow marching behind it, and it went up the slope to its final resting place. And I thought, okay, maybe that's the end for me. That's the closure I've been seeking. As I told you, I went on the ski holiday. I came back. In about February of 2014, an email arrived in my inbox from Mam Grasa. She invited all of us again, all of the presidential protection detail, to a tea at the Nelson Mandela Center for Memory in Houghton to say thank you to us for looking after her husband all of those years. She had done that for the medical team. She had done that for the office staff and the foundation staff, and now it was our turn. And in this magnificent auditorium there in Houghton, she got up and thanked us. And she said to us, "You guys were always there. Doesn't matter what the president was doing or where he went, you were always there." And she said, "I know that very often that would have demanded considerable sacrifice. And I just want to say thank you." So if my task today is to give all of you the lessons that I learned from Madiba, in order that you pass them on to those young men whose lives you have the privilege of affecting before they become the next generation of world leaders, then the first one is that we should never forget to say thank you. It is such a simple thing just to say thank you. And this dignified, beautiful lady in mourning and wearing full black because her husband had just been laid to rest, with everything else that was going on around him and around her, with so much dignity and grace, she stood up there and said thank you to a bunch of cops and former cops. And it had a profound effect on me. And I want you to remember to teach those boys whom you teach to say thank you. I remember a time coming into the Union Buildings. The Union Buildings in Pretoria is the seat of government of the South African government. And it's, I suppose it's like the White House or some of those institutions in the countries that you come from. But it's a beautiful sandstone building sitting right on top of a kopi. A kopi is a small little hill. I'm not sure what's interfering with that one.
Oh, no, it's good. It's good.
I'll take it. Yeah. Is this one working?
I'll hold this in my hand.
Oh, I see.
And then if you need it, I'll...
Thank you. Apologies for that. So I was telling you that the union buildings sit on this kuppie in Pretoria, and the president had a private entrance around the back where we would drop him off every morning as he came there to do his daily job. And you know, I used to have this interesting little, in fact, it was an extraordinary privilege, because as the team leader of one of the protection teams, when my team was on duty, it was my duty every day to brief the president in his home about tomorrow's program. Imagine that. Imagine 2 minutes every day, one-on-one time with Madiba. And we would always have this debate. I always say it's rather like bartering with an Indian shopkeeper. You know, he knows the price, I know the price I want to pay. He's going to start high, I'm going to go low, and we're going to meet in the middle, you know? So I used to always tell Madiba, Dada, tomorrow your first appointment is 7:30 in the office with so-and-so. And I then knew we would want to get there at about 7:15. So let's leave at 6:30. I've already factored all the things in that I need to factor, like traffic and others. He would then say, no, let's leave at 6:15. So I would always say, we leave at 6:45, and he would say, leave at 6:30. I'd say, perfect. That day, everything went right. There was little traffic on the M1 going north to Pretoria. Every light was green. Man, we arrived at the union buildings at like 10 to 7. You know, office hours start at 7:30. There's nobody there. It's a ghost town. And as we walk into the back door, this back entrance, there is an African lady, a cleaner, down on all fours, polishing the floor. A concrete floor like this one, except it's red, highly glossed. And Madiba literally nearly walks into her behind. You know, he kind of, as we come in there. And he stops and he says to her, yes, mama? And she hears that voice and she gets the fright of her life. And she tries to stand, apologize, and greet him all at the same time. She's almost kneeling at attention there, you know, on this floor. And the president just says, no. It's okay, mama. It's okay. What's your name? Where do you come from? Where do your parents come from? How long have you worked here? And thank you for keeping our office so beautifully clean. And then he went to the office. And me and my colleagues standing there were wondering to ourselves, what have we just heard? And today, I still work in, let's call it, in VIP circles because of some of the clients that we have. And I see important people, chairmen, CEOs, managing directors and the like, who don't have the common decency to greet the tea lady in the morning when he walks into the office and she says, good morning, sir. And I say to you, sir, I think nothing of you. Because if Madiba can take the time to greet the cleaning lady down on her hands and knees, polishing the floor at the union buildings, and who are you not to return a greeting of an employee who says, good morning, sir? So that's the second lesson that I learned from him. Actually, it's the third, because the second lesson was the all-important one of being punctual. Madiba was never late. Although the story I'm going to tell you just now will tell you of the one occasion, probably the only occasion that I know of when he was late, and it wasn't his fault. Punctuality was everything to him. And, you know, like most old men, Madiba could get grumpy. And nothing made him grumpier than people who were late, especially other heads of state, especially those somewhere to the north of our borders. I'll stop there. So guys, that's how it ended for me. It ended for me with this incredible tea that Mam Grasa gave us at the Nelson Mandela Center for Memory. And all she was doing was calling us together to say, thank you. I remember and I recognize and I acknowledge all that you did for my husband. And that was something I've never forgotten. So that's how it ended. What about the beginning? How did this white cop, as Vernon said, you know, started in the apartheid South African police force, and we then morphed into the South African police service as democracy came. How did I land up as one of Madiba's team leaders? Well, the first thing you need to know is that it was nothing to do with me. I wasn't headhunted. I wasn't handpicked or carefully selected or any of that stuff. I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And this is kind of how it happened, and I'll keep this brief. I was part of the dreaded, notorious security police of the apartheid state. And I was recruited into the security police precisely because I'm English speaking. And we had this campus, this hotbed of activism there called Wits University, where there were all these little lefty students running around there agitating. So they needed English-speaking people to keep an eye on them. Now, I'm being facetious. That's not why I was recruited. So I was recruited and placed in the churches section. One of the ladies that I was there to monitor in the churches section was the secretary to the general secretary of the South African Council of Churches. She's no longer with us. Her name is Miriam Kadana. And I'll come back to Sis Mary in a minute when I tell you another story. So I used to listen to the tapes of her telephone that we as the security police had bugged in the security branch. And then one day, at the beginning of 1990, it happened to be the 2nd of February, then State President F.W. de Klerk makes this extraordinary announcement in Parliament that he's going to unban the ANC, the PAC, the South African Communist Party, and he's going to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. Now, I can tell you that heads of state making speeches is not, you know, not many people pay attention to that while we're having tea in the morning at John Forster Square. But our ears kind of perked up when we heard him say that. And the result of him saying that was, as he signed those statements into law, we as the special branch all of a sudden had no more work. Because the illegal persons and the illegal organizations that we were monitoring were all of a sudden legal ones. So they didn't know what to do with this young greenhorn wet behind the ears lieutenant. So they said, Stain, you go and start the VIP protection section at the security branch. I said, okay. And I did. So I used to look after all the National Party cabinet ministers and even FW himself when he came to Joburg on the odd occasion from the official residence up the highway in Pretoria. Now fast forward that movie 4 years to the 10th of May 1994. You all know what happened, well, the South Africans know what happened on the 10th of May 1994. Nelson Mandela was sworn in as South Africa's first democratically elected president at those very same union buildings. And if you've seen the movie Invictus, where Morgan Freeman plays Madiba, does such a great job of playing Madiba, you'll see him swear that oath of office there. And if you haven't seen Invictus, my goodness, that's the first thing you do when you get back home after this conference. I get a telex, not an email, not even a fax, a telex, telling me that the newly elected president will go from the union buildings, having sworn the oath of office, to Ellis Park to attend a soccer match. Thinking, what on earth is that about? Why would you do that on your inauguration day? And the reason for that was that somebody very bright on the inauguration committee decided that if we put 60,000 soccer fans into Ellis Park, broadcast the entire inauguration ceremony on the big screens in the stadium, then that is 60,000 fewer people clogging up the M1 trying to get to the union buildings to see it live. And more importantly, 60,000 fewer people clogging up the lawns of the union buildings. If you go and see Invictus again, or for the first time, the footage of those crowds on the lawn there is the real footage of inauguration day. There wasn't space for six more people, never mind 60,000 more people. So it was actually a stroke of genius. So Madiba swears the oath of office, gets in a helicopter, and flies to Joburg. It's only 60 Ks. So the flight is maybe 20 minutes by helicopter. He lands on the roof of what was then the Witwatersrand Technikon. I think it's now part of Wits University. And it's right next to the stadium. The motorcade drives him around the corner, up a vehicle ramp, and on, across a wooden floor, much like the one where you're seated on, and at about the same size. So if you picture that the screen behind me here was the doors to the president's suite, and the field of play is beyond that, This motorcade comes and drives around and stops here. All the South African Football Association officials are waiting there to greet Madiba. And he was supposed to get there before the kickoff and greet the teams on the field, you know, like presidents do, right? But because things ran a bit late there at the Union Buildings, which were totally without his control, he arrived only at half time. So that was the only time that I know Madiba to arrive late, and it wasn't his fault. So he goes into these doors. On the right is a lift. He goes down to the tunnel level. He walks out of the tunnel onto the field of play and greets the two teams. South Africa playing Zambia. Bafana Bafana versus Chipolo Polo. The score is 0-0, and that's significant. He greets the teams. He goes back into the tunnel. He comes back up the lift. He walks out of the president's suite and immediately makes his apology and says, guys, I've got to get back to Pretoria because there are 184 heads of state waiting there for me to host them for lunch. Now, South Africans, cast your minds back. Can you remember who attended Madiba's inauguration on the 10th of May, 1994? It was all the people that we in the security branch had been taught had horns on their head somewhere. All the devils. Gaddafi, Arafat, Fidel Castro. Those people that would never have been permitted to come in or nor wanted to come into South Africa under the apartheid government. They came to Madiba's inauguration. And my job as the head of VIP protection in Joburg was to secure all of the hotels that they were in. That was an interesting exercise, ladies and gentlemen. Because here's the thing. Believe it or not, there is an international order of precedence, a kind of like a protocol precedence amongst heads of state. And the ones that are the most senior are those that have been in power the longest. Guess who that is? Gaddafi, Mugabe, Arafat, Fidel Castro. And they've got to arrive last. So you have to arrive in the reverse order of your ranking in terms of this list of precedents. So we have to get them out of those hotels into their motorcades and up the highway in a very strict schedule. They had to arrive 2 minutes apart. Now you try going to a dictator and telling him, sir, you need to leave now. Good luck with that. But we got them up the highway. And I had a few minutes, literally a few minutes, because that was a crazy time. I was in the Balalaika Hotel in Sandton. I put my feet up and I got some coffee. And I had like 45 minutes just to watch the swearing-in ceremony on TV before I had to go to Ellis Park to receive our new president at the president's suite. Let me pause the movie there and tell you about an encounter I had with the black police officers that served under my command. They came knocking on my door in about February of 94. On the 7th floor of John Forster Square. And they said to me, Major, can we see you? I said, yeah, guys, get in here. What's up? And they said, look, we are black cops in the security police. And they said, you know how collaborators with the system are dealt with. And if you can remember those sickening visuals on TV, then I don't need to say anything further. They said, what is going to become of us if the ANC win the election in a few months' time? And you didn't need to be Nostradamus to know that the ANC stood a very good chance of winning the 94 election. I said to them, guys, I don't know the answer to that question, but my sense is we'll be okay, but let me find out. So I phoned my boss in police head office in Pretoria, a colonel in charge of VIP protection, and I told him what I've just told you. And this dear colonel started to shout at me down the phone in Afrikaans. He said, these things are being deliberated at a senior level and you will be informed once we know that the ANC is going to win the election. So that was February of 94. What's it today? 10th of July, I've lost track of the time, being in New Zealand and all over the place. Anyway, it's July 2015. I'm still waiting to be informed of what will happen. So I decided, well, look, I'm still the VIP protection commander in Johannesburg. I better go to Ellis Park and do what I would have done if it had been declared coming to rugby there. So I went. And here comes this motorcade. President now excuses himself and says he's got to get back to Pretoria. He gets back into the car, and instead of driving back out the vehicle ramp over there to go to the helicopter, we see him trying to get the door of this car open, but he's just got in. That might sound like something quite simple, but it's a 3.8-ton armored BMW. You can't just flick your elbow and the door opens when you're 70-something years old. You know, you need a team leader standing outside to give it a good sharp tug. So the team leader opens the door, and he almost exasperatedly asks him, you know, like, "Dada, what is it? You know, you've just got in. You know, he doesn't say a word to the team leader. He gets out of the car. He walks around the bonnet of the car, and he starts heading across this polished wooden floor to the vehicle ramp over there where he should be driving out. So we kind of like follow on, confused as anything. And the only person standing there is an old apartheid era police colonel in his blue uniform with his castles and stars on his shoulder and his scrambled egg on his police cap. And his eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the president walks directly towards him. And Madiba stops in front of him and he puts out his hand and says to him, "Colonel, I just want you to know that today you have become our police. I'm now the president of this country, but you need to know that there's no more you and us. From today, you are our police." Now guys, when I tell you that this old dude had enough lines on his face to prove that he'd been there and seen it all, he started crying. And the tears were running down those lines on his face, and they were dripping like this onto the polished parquet floor. And Madiba just patted him on the shoulder and he said, "It's okay, Colonel. I just needed to tell you that today." And then he turned on his heel and he walked back to the car. Now, if I tell you that he could just as well, I was utterly astounded. He could just as well have spoken those words to me personally, because my rank was only one rank lower than that colonel. I was a lieutenant colonel at the time. And from that day, I started to question all of this conditioning and input and training that I'd received as a cop, especially as a security branch cop, because we were taught the ideology of the ANC. Of course we were, man. That's warfare 101. You need to understand your enemy's strategy. And we were at war. Four years ago, when he was released from Victor Verster prison, where did Madiba go? As the world literally waited for those incredible images, and the entire world's media hung on every word he was going to say. What is Nelson Mandela going to say in the first speech he's going to make as a free man after 27 years of incarceration? Well, he went to the Grand Parade in Cape Town, not far from here. If you're Bubba Watson, it's probably a drive and a three wood from where we're standing. Not quite. There's a mountain in the way. Madiba went from the prison to the Grand Parade in Cape Town, and he stood up there with, as I say, literally everybody hanging off his words. Why were they hanging off his words? Not just because he was incarcerated for 27 years, but because it was a criminal offense to publish a photograph of Nelson Mandela. And it was a criminal offense to publish any quotation that he made, because he was a banned person. So we didn't even know what he looked like, never mind what he was going to say. And he stood up there, and amongst other things he said, quoting from the Freedom Charter, he said, "South Africa is for all her people, both black and white." And this cynical white cop sitting in my office on the 7th floor of John Forster Square listening to that lot was going, "Yeah, yeah, whatever. Of course you're going to say that. That's the party line. I didn't expect anything different. It's just rhetoric, you know." But when I witnessed that exchange with that colonel on the day he became our president, man, did I begin to question a lot of stuff that I'd experienced in my life. And I was 30-something years old. How do you undo 30-odd years of conditioning, you know, from a system like the one in which I grew up in? So I started to watch him very, very closely, Because I still thought that this was all a facade. It's what you do, it's what you say to get votes. But it didn't take more than a couple of months for me to realize, hey, this is no facade. He's absolutely genuine about this agenda of his to build one South Africa. South Africa is for all her people, both black and white. It then took me a few years of research and kind of understanding this man that I was serving to know that that is exactly consistent with what he said before he went to prison. In that famous statement from the dock at the treason trial, before he went to jail in 64, he said that I have fought against white domination and I have fought against black domination. And I cherish the ideal of seeing a South Africa that is free and for all of its citizens. I'm paraphrasing, it's a long statement. Now folks, if I tell you that the 5 years that I served Madiba were the best 5 years of my life, then I would have to say that if you asked me to pick kind of like the highlight of those 5 years, then it would have to be the 4 days that we went to the UK on a state visit in 1996. You can say what you like, but nobody on this planet can do pomp and ceremony like the Poms. They are world beaters. They've also had centuries of practice, and boy, have they used it. Brilliant. I mean, we saw that a couple of years ago, didn't we, when the Queen celebrated her 60th Jubilee. Brilliant, the stuff that they put on there. Now, I was at the London Olympics a couple of years ago, 2012, and I watched beach volleyball on Horse Guards Parade, for heaven's sake. Stroke of genius. The people on that organizing committee that chose those venues for the London Olympics, they should receive the Nobel Prize for choosing Olympic venues. Who would have thought? Dump a couple of hundred tons of beach sand onto Horse Guards Parade. Well, when I was on Horse Guards Parade in 1996, that's where the Queen, with the full household cavalry drawn up there on that beautiful parade ground, welcomed Madiba as her guest on a state visit. And the Queen gave the President a suite of rooms in Buckingham Palace called the Belgian Suite. It's on the ground floor. Madiba's knees weren't in that great shape at the time, although he still used to do his 5 a.m. walk. Imagine those poms when I told him that the president's going to walk at 5 in the morning. 5 in the morning to the Brits is like 3 in the morning to South Africans. Man, it's early. Nobody walks at that time. And assigned to the Belgian suite were 3 staff members of Buckingham Palace, a footman, a valet, and a butler. In that beautiful livery of the pinstripe trousers and the starched white shirt and the long grey tailcoat. And what impressed Madiba so much was that every time he went in or out of the doors of the Belgian suite, these 3 guys were there. And it really wasn't rocket science, because they just used to ask us, look, what time does the president want to get up? So that, you know, the butler made sure he was there on time. And when we finished whatever it was we were doing that day and we went home, then, you know, they would say, is the president okay? You know, what does he need? The valet would press the suit and the shirt for the following day. And once he'd retired and they were sure of that, they would go to bed. But Madiba was impressed by these 3 guys. So on the final day of the state visit, he says to that lady who I mentioned earlier, Miriam Kadana, the one whose phones I bugged as a security branch cop, was Madiba's principal private secretary. How cool is that? And we laughed on many occasions over a cup of tea in her office at the Union Buildings about the time that I used to bug her phone and listen to her conversations. 3/4 of which I couldn't understand because she was probably speaking Xhosa at the time. But be that as it may, Madiba says to Sis Mary, Mary, I'd like to take a photograph with the staff. So Mary passes the message on, as you do, as a personal secretary, through the channels to the master of the household. Now, the master of the household of Buckingham Palace is a retired Major General of the British Army, because there are 600 staff in that palace. And I always want to say that he commands. So we go out and we do our thing. Amongst other things, we got a bit lost in Brixton that day with Prince Charles, but that really is a story for another day. Beautiful story. And we come back into the palace after what really was a long day and an equally long week. It's the end of the state visit. And as we walk into the Belgian suite, and there the three guys are, here appears the master of the household. And the general says, "Mr. President, we're ready for the photograph." So Madiba looks at us, and we look at one another and at him, and we kind of communicate to one another, okay, let's see where this goes. So Madiba says, "Well, what would you like me to do, General?" He said, "Well, follow me, sir." And out the door he goes. Onto the lawns of Buckingham Palace, walks around the side of the palace to that part of the lawn where the Queen hosts those quarterly garden parties for British citizens. And there, on the lawns of Buckingham Palace, these crazy poms have lined up all 600 staff of the palace. They've built a scaffolding, for heaven's sake. There are six rows, beautifully arranged, tallest in the middle, sliding down to the sides like that. And two spaces in the front row, in the middle. And the general says very proudly, "Mr. President, would you stand here?" Madiba dutifully goes and stands there. Next to the general, his chest puffed out, and click flash goes the official photographer, and this very unique and very rare, I'm sure, photograph gets taken of the president with the entire staff of the palace. And the general then says, "Very well, sir, we're done." And we walk back into the room. And as we get inside, Madiba looks at all of us, who are shaking our heads and smiling. And he says, "Does anybody have a camera?" And I can't remember whether it was Sis Mary or Zanani. Madiba's daughter Zanani was the official companion on that visit because it was before he had married Mrs. Michelle. One of them pulled a little aim and fire camera out of their handbag, and the old man said, "Man, just call those three chaps." Because that's all he wanted. Great story. Another story that I remember, and it's to the ladies, and I know there's not as many ladies here today as there are men, but ladies really ask the most wonderful questions. And once I was asked, forget by whom, "Rory, were you ever moved by the things that you saw the president do?" And I was like thinking, "Lady, what kind of question's that, man? I'm a bodyguard, for heaven's sake. Moved? You know?" And then it didn't take me long to realize that there were times that I was very profoundly moved by the things that I was privileged to see. And it brought to mind this story about the state visit arrival of President Rawlings, Jerry Rawlings of Ghana, who came to South Africa. Now, if Parliament is in session, you know, we in this country have got this bizarre structure in our government where we actually have three seats of power, but you know, the judicial one is in Bloemfontein. But Parliament is here in Cape Town. But all the government offices are up in Joburg, the Union Buildings being one of them. Weird. So we spend all this taxpayers' money on giving our ministers two official residences, two official cars, and two sets of offices. Like we're the richest nation on earth and we can afford that, you know? But anyway, if Parliament is in session down here in Cape Town, then this arrival ceremony that I'm about to describe to you happens here in Cape Town at Tainace, our Parliament building, also just down the road. But it was at the Union Buildings when Jerry Rawlings came to visit, and if you can picture that magnificent building there with the amphitheater in the middle where he swore the oath of office, and you've got two wings, east and west, and you've got a big staircase that kind of flows down the contours of that building onto the roadway that again is about as wide as this hall you're sitting in, and there are three semicircular steps much like these ones at the bottom where Madiba stands to await the arrival of his guests. So here comes President Rawlings' convoy. It pulls up here. There's a red carpet in the road. There's a full military guard of honor beyond the red carpet, and beyond that over there is a scaffolding, a small one, built for the TV cameras of the world's press. And at the head of the guard of honor is a military band. There are no bodyguards with dark glasses and dark suits jumping out of the car and making the whole thing look a mess. There are just two full colonels with white gloves on who open the door of the visiting president's car. He climbs up the steps. Motorcade drives away. He stands shoulder to shoulder with our president. They face the guard of honor, and the national anthems are played by the band. A 21-gun salute is fired by a battery of four cannon from Voortrekker Hoogte, now known as Tabatswane. And then the young captain in command of the Guard of Honor will march up and very smartly salute the two presidents with his saber and invite the visiting president to inspect his Guard of Honor, which really just means that President Rawlings goes down the stairs again and he marches up and down the front rank of the Guard of Honor while Madiba stands a second time and awaits his return to the step. All that must then happen is that the chief of protocol will come down and he will invite the two presidents to go upstairs into the union buildings for talks. And on the way up the staircase, the entire cabinet of the government of the Republic of South Africa are standing and waiting for their president to introduce the guest to them. So on cue, here comes John Reinders, the head of protocol, and he says, "Your Excellencies, would you come with me?" And instead of turning and going up the stairs, Madiba says to him, "John, roep die kind." And he points like this. I'm standing behind a granite pillar that's holding up this roof here. And John looks at me and I go, "I don't know." And he says, "Excuse me, Mr. President?" And he says, and this is the translation, he says, "Call that child. I can't see any child because I've got a pillar in front of me. About that diameter. I'm standing there precisely so that the TV cameras can't see me. The president's back is just down there." So John goes. He says, "Well, the president says call the child. I better go call the child." So here goes the head of protocol. Down the steps, across the red carpet, through the soldiers. And he comes back with this kid in tow. Through the soldiers, as confused as all of us, across the red carpet, up onto the steps. Now I get to see him. Little white Afrikaner kid, about 11 years old, in his school tracksuit. The badge on there, navy blue tracksuit with the school badge on the chest. And it's 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. Teachers, what the heck is he doing there? And he's by himself, by the way. And Madiba bends down and he says to him, "What's your name? Where do you come from? What school do you go to?" Asking these random questions, this poor little kid is as intimidated as a rabbit in the headlights. He's standing there looking up like this. And then he says to the child, "Well, this is President Rawlings of Ghana." As if this oak even knows where Ghana is. And that was the point that I started to kind of swallow hard on this lump in my throat as I witnessed this from behind my pillar. Because it said so much more to me than one black president calling a little white kid across and introducing him to another black president. It was kind of like the same message I got that day a few years before with that exchange between the colonel and the president at Ellis Park. Because what Madiba was saying was, look, this is a very formal ceremony. It's a state visit arrival with guards of honor, military bands, and salutes. But that doesn't matter. Because this is just a chance to introduce a child to my guest. And by the way, all those VIPs standing on the steps there waiting for me to introduce them can blooming well wait. Same as those 184 heads of state that day. He was late that day, ladies and gentlemen. But 184 heads of state, including the Vice President of the United States, and his wife, Ellen Tipper Gore. Hillary Clinton was there. Bill Clinton didn't come. Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, was representing the Queen there. And all these other heads of state that I've mentioned, they can wait because that colonel needs to hear this message from me today. So the lesson that I learned from that is that circumstances and all the stuff that goes on around us doesn't matter. If there's a message that needs to be communicated, the colonel needs to be told he's now no longer our enemy from today. This kid can just have an opportunity to meet my guest, the president of Ghana, then all those other big shots can wait. You know, I don't think you can ever teach or coach or train that kind of common touch. I think it's probably something that you're born with. But I learned that day that all of that stuff that we think is so important, it's not. Take the time to foster some sort of a relationship or make some kind of a gesture to another person that will have an everlasting effect on their life and the way that they see the world. Madiba thought that that was more important than sticking with the program. And I loved him for that. I love the fact that as I stand here before you today, I served a president who would be quite happy to deviate from the official program and just start to interact randomly and unofficially with ordinary South Africans. I love that about him. You don't always have to stick with that program. One day we came from this very same Cape Town from Parliament. It was a Friday, I remember. And for whatever reason, Parliament didn't go into the evening as it normally would. And then we fly back to Waterkloof Air Force Base. And then we go home to his home in Johannesburg in Houghton. We got up here, well, up there. We got up to Waterkloof at about midday. And instead of going there, we think, great, it's Friday, we're going to get the afternoon off, work is done, it's going to be an early weekend. No, he says, he calls me, he says, Rory, we need to go to Secunda. Secunda. I said, Dada, why do we need to go to Secunda? Secunda, guys, is a quarter horse mining town about an hour's drive east of Joburg, where there's not much happening. It's flat, and it's dusty, because it's gold mining country. I said, why are we going to Secunda? He said, because there's a young lady there who is dying of a terminal disease, and she expressed as her dying wish to meet the president. So we're going to go and meet her. It's not on the program. I subsequently found out, and I honestly, hand on heart, only found this out about 2 months ago because I had a conversation with somebody who told me that Ahmed Kathrada, who was one of the Rivonia trialists imprisoned on Robben Island with Madiba and a long-standing friend of the president's, he had told Madiba about this young lady on the plane from Cape Town to Pretoria. They had this exchange about this young lady that he had met. And he said he's going to take the president to see her. So the president said, well, there's no time like the president, like the present. Sorry. We've got half a day. Let's go to Secunda now. So I, as the team leader, am frantically phoning ahead, mobilizing cops in Secunda who have no idea that the president is coming to this hospital on this day. Fortunately, as I said, we had an hour's drive. Not a lot of time, but, you know, if we don't know where we're going, neither do the bad guys kind of scenario, you know. So to Secunda we went, and into this ward walked the president with this little girl with not a hair on her head, dying of whatever terminal disease she was suffering from, lay there. And he spent 20 minutes just talking to her. And you could see that she was really struggling, and I don't think she lasted very long after that. And then he went from her ward to every other children's ward in that hospital. And we spent the entire day at Secunda Hospital visiting kids and probably any other people that he happened to encounter. And I don't know what it is with nurses. They completely lose their minds when the president or when he walks into their hospital. All of a sudden you've got nurses ululating and singing and dancing in the aisles and the passages and the corridors. And forget about the patients, man. We'll worry about them later. Madiba's here. Crazy. I recall the time, and I've already got the 5 minute warning, so I do apologize if I've bored you and I'm going to wind up, but I remember the times that we used to go when he was courting Mam Grasa. Madiba would insist on going personally to buy her flowers or chocolate or jewelry. Simple, you may think. Do you know what happens when Nelson Mandela walks into Sandton City to go to the chocolate shop and buy chocolates for the lady that he's courting? It is chaos. And it was the days before, way before social media, but SMSs on a cell phone were alive and well. And within seconds, the entire shopping center knew that Madiba was in whatever shop he was in. One day we were in a bookshop, He was buying a book that he wanted. And we, our plan of action was we go in there and we kind of like leave the people that are in there. We all keep an eye on whatever group of shoppers is in there. Then we close the doors. And he said to me, Rory, no man, don't close the doors. I said, Dada, if we leave these doors open, those people are going to come in here and steal all these books. He said, okay, okay, close them. So we learned to work around this this wonderful desire that he had to truly be a president of all his people. He insisted that all of his staff were representative of all of the racial groups in South Africa, and that included his bodyguard. So I was one of the team leaders. I had a black 2IC, and the other team was led by a black guy, and he had a white former cop from my kind of era as his 2IC. And I was proud and privileged to lead a wonderful group of men and women. Yes, there were women there. They were brilliant. You know, men have got one problem. Well, many, but one of the particular problems that we have as men is this three-letter word called ego. You get a good-looking girl who wants to get her book signed by the president, who comes up to us and flutters her eyelids and says, please, can I get the book signed? We're probably going to say, yeah, okay, if we can make it happen, we will. You try that with a female protector. She just says, no, go and stand over there. Case closed, you know. So I implore you, as I've said, I'm a proud husband of a teacher. I've seen from a very special perspective, you know, the relationship that happens between parents and a school. Because I see it from my wife's perspective as a member of staff, and I see it from my perspective as a parent. You know, whether that's on a rugby tour or standing next to the field or just attending an assembly where awards are given to pupils that do well. And I just implore you, as I've said, you have this wonderful privilege of affecting the lives of men who will lead our countries. Please, a request from me, teach them the things that Madiba stood for. And what are the things that he stood for? Obviously, things like reconciliation and humility and goodness and kindness. Those are the things that I want you to teach your young men to remember and to teach to their children. Guys, the age of chivalry really isn't dead. Gentlemen in this politically correct, crazy world of ours can still be gentlemen and can still remember things like common courtesy, say thank you, acknowledge other people, irrespective of who they are. So with that, I'll close. And I'll thank you for having me here today, Guy and Vernon. And I wish you well, safe travels to wherever you're going. And don't get grumpy Pommies and Kiwis, Aussies, when we come and fetch the Rugby World Cup in September. Okay. Take care.